Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to kick off. Welcome and thank you for coming. Obviously, my name is Jeff Carr. We're here to discuss the impact IFRS 16 accounting change for Ahold Delhaize. I think there's a full 2018 quarter-by-quarter restatement available on the web, and also a copy of the presentation is available. I'm here with quite a team. I've got Wouter Niemeyer with me today, who's actually going to go through it. Wouter's been living IFRS 16 for a few months now. He is the SVP Corporate Accounting and Tax at Ahold Delhaize, and Wouter's here to answer, and we'll go through a lot of the presentation and answer more of the technical questions for the standard. Also with me, I've got Henk Jan, who you all know, Emily, Alvin, I think all of you know, and Harmjan Peterson at the back there also, who is part of our communications team. We're here, this is our corporate comms agency, so we're using this room for today. So without further ado, I will kick off. I'm going to go through the highlights and then very quickly actually hand over to Wouter, and I'll come back with some of the key points in terms of guidance and such forth. Now, I think all of you have heard various updates. I know Tesco and some of the other companies have already given updates. But basically, nothing new from our perspective. There's no impact on the business and how we manage it as such because of the standard. Cash flow is not impacted, and I'll come to later. I saw one or two reports. Obviously, free cash flow, the KPI we use, is adjusted as we include finance lease repayments into it, which was below the line previously. But it doesn't affect our net cash flow or our cash position. Obviously, we're bringing $7.9 billion of debt onto the balance sheet, and there's a restatement of the income statement. We'll go through that. No material impact on underlying earnings per share. Actually, there's a 3-cent impact in 2018 in terms of it's quite different, I think, from the update from Tesco. No impact on our capital allocation policy, although our headline net debt to EBITDA number does go up as a consequence of bringing more debt onto the balance sheet than the basic 8x multiple. But we won't change our approach to capital allocation. And obviously the outlook for free cash flow, net cash is unchanged, but we now bring... There's no differentiation between operating leases and finance leases, so we will now bring finance lease repayments into that KPI definition. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Wouter.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, and good morning, everybody. So I'm going to walk you through the impact of the IFRS. The IFRS 16 accounting change, like Jeff said, there's absolutely no impact on cash. This is a pure accounting change, but a rather significant accounting change for a company like Ahold Delhaize. And I think if you look back at our history, I think when the adoption of IFRS in 2005 was very significant, and this is probably the most significant accounting change. In particular for Ahold Delhaize, why it is impact, because we are heavy on leases, mainly stores, distribution centers, and car leases. But I think in particular, we already hold finance leases, around 20%, with quite a portfolio on sub-leases. I will come back to that. There's changes in accounting for that. And we are impacted by, this is the third element, by the merger accountant, the merger between Aalt and the Hersen that happened in 2016, as you know. So the adoption of IFRS 16, there are multiple approaches that you can do for the adoption. We decided through the full retrospective approach, which means that we implement IFRS 16 as if this was already the case years ago. So all the contracts, we go back to the inception and account for it like IFRS 16 was already in place. So for example, contracts from the 90s to the 80s, we still account for it as if IFRS 16 was in place at the time. The reason why we do it is because going forward, it improves our comparability. Because we have this accounting standard going forward, and if you've done the past as well, the numbers are very comparable. The impact of the full retrospective approach is around 580 million recorded as a debit to our equity. What we provided to you is an IFRS restatement booklet. And what we have done is we've restated the full 2018. We provided you every quarter. So the restatement of Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4. We have provided all the performance measures based on the new standards, as well as the new accounting policy, as well as the definitions, where we have one updated definition for free cash flow. So when you implement these standards, there are some practical exemptions that you can use, and we use two of them. So for all our short-term leases, shorter than 12 months, or a low-value lease, so if the underlying asset has a value less than $5,000, printers, computers, they are not included in IFRS 16 accounting. So we still do the old accounting for those leases. Then if I briefly explain IFRS 16 in an example and come back why sublease and the accounting is different, I will make it clear what will happen with our numbers. So let me give you an example. So assume that we're going to open a new, let's say, Stop Store by the 1st of April, and we enter into a lease of 10 years. So in the old standards, you'll just book every year a operational rent expense for this store. Under the new standards, the lease will come onto our balance sheet. She will count the net present value and basically book a right of use asset as well as a finance liability for this 10-year lease. What happens in our income statement? Of course, this right of use asset needs to be depreciated as if it was an asset and building that we own. So we depreciate it in 10 years, straight line. And of course, on the liability, you pay interest and you have redemption of your loan. So what the impact on our numbers, what it will be is that the depreciation is a straight line, but the financial liability follows an annuity pattern. So in the beginning, you have a high interest expense. And as this lease moves on, the interest expense gets less because you redeem every year part of your financial liability. The accounting folks call this the front-loaded impact on a particular lease. Of course, it's different if you have a full lease portfolio, and we have a rather mature lease portfolio, so in our numbers, we don't see a huge impact of this front-load impact on our income after tax. It's good to explain sublease accounting, because we are impacted by sublease accounting. In principle, sublease accounting did not change under this new standard. However, for us there is an impact because there is a somewhat new rule, and which is called we act as an intermediate lease for sublease. So let me explain an example so you can see the difference, because we have both of these contracts in our lease portfolio. So I continue with this Stop and Shop store, 10-year lease. So now assume that we come to make a deal with Dunkin' Donuts, East Coast is Dunkin' Donuts, I think, and we agree that they're going to build their store in our store and also have a 10-year contract. So yeah, they use 10% of our floor space, So we have a sublease with Belgium. So this sublease, we act as the intermediary. We are holding of the head lease, and they are a lessor, so we act as a landlord. Because this is 10 years, it's a 10 years sublease, and our contract is also 10 years, we basically send our risk and rewards of this 10% floor space to Dunkin' Belgium. So what happens in the accounting is we need to de-recognize 10% of our right of use assets, so it's no longer us, and we recognize a receivable, because this is what we call a financial sublease. So that's why we also have receivables on our balance sheet. There is another way of accounting. It would be an operational sublease. And this happens, for example, if it's not a 10-year contract, but only a 3-year contract, so that we still hold the risk of this asset, so then we have an operational sublease. So in this case, we'll keep the right to use assets on our balance sheet, so we have rental income for this contract with Dunkin' Belgium. Remember, there are two ways to account for subleases. I'm going to go through the numbers, because there is an impact. Discount rates are important because the discount rate set basically the interest charge. So under IFRS 16, basically all rent expenses split into depreciation and interest. So depending on your discount rate, you have a bigger or less interest expense, and the depreciation charge is allocated to our margin. So the bigger the interest expense is, the less expenses are allocated to our operating income. So this is a highlight, basically, brief how IFRS 16 works. But then the impact on our numbers. And these are basically the restatement booklets that we provided to you this morning. So let me explain a few of the items, and I will explain basically the impact of the adoption of IFRS 16. So the first one, it's your operating expenses, so they go down with 227, and I have a separate slide for it for the breakdown. And basically what happens here is we take out our rent expense and we put back the depreciation charge, and you see that it will drive up our margin because the interest expense is no longer in our margin. The interest expense is basically now presented in the finance. You see an offset of 241, which is the interest expense. You also see that this is higher, so this means that we have some of this front-loaded impact in our interest. Not so significant. Then of course you calculate the after-tax, and you see a rather strange income tax benefit, and that's really to explain. So for tax, we assume that this IFRS 16 accounting methodology will not be accepted by the most of the tax authorities, and so they would still be open to reports, because we want to defer tax position of all of these pieces. So then if you make a restatement column, you would expect a very blended statutory tax rate. However, there is a wage reform with the Netherlands increase. So we have adopted IFRS 16 by the 1st of January 2018, and this rate reform happened at the end of 2018. So there is some impact on rate reform, recalculating all the deferred taxes, why this is only one, and it is not the tax rate. Joint ventures, of course, we also implemented IFRS 16 in our joint ventures, so that's the impact for the JMR and Superindo, and if you calculate this, basically you have a net income impact of only 13 million. In our definitions for our underlying income, in the past we already backed out the gains and losses from the sale of assets. So what we've done under IFRS 16, we also backed out the gain and losses on our leases. So basically, 2018 is that if you terminate a lease, it will be all, in almost every case it will be the gain. And the reason is because your depreciation is much faster, so the asset value is lower than your liability. So if you terminate it, or you need to get rid of it in your balance sheet, you will have a gain. So that's why we decided not to include these gains in our net income number. So that's why you see impact here. And we have in 2018, it's minus only 5 million, some reversals of impact. So in total, we have an adjustment of 22. And after tax, you see the impact on the underlying income from continuous operations. And then you can calculate our earnings per share, which is, say, 3%. Basically, the 3% mainly relates because we back out these gains, otherwise, more or less flat. So this happens on our income statement, and if you see, maybe I should tell you, if you look at the breakdown of the net finance expense, there's like 255 million interest expense. We also have interest income around 50 million. That's the interest income for the new subleases. Yeah? So we put the sublease, so we stop the counting down and store for 10% on our balance sheet. And it doesn't generate rental income, but it generates interest income. And you see this here is basically what I already explained. So here we made a breakdown of the 227, which is the same number as here, the impact on our operating expenses. Now you can see the details. So we had a net rent expense. A net rent expense. So in the past we had like operational rent expense as well as income, rent income, when we have sublease which was not on our balance sheet. So we have around a billion no longer of rent expense included on that line item. And see that the end, minus 125. Minus 125 basically represents these subleases, rental income, which are not on the balance sheet. Because like I said, we have also subleases where we have operational subleases. The example of a Stop & Shop, where we only had a 3-year contract with Dunkin' Donuts, so there we still have rental income. Actually, there's another item in here, and that is our low-value leases and our short-term leases. So like I said in the beginning, they are excluded from IFRS 16, so there are still an expense of around 60 million sitting in this number. So it's like 185 rental income, 60 million. Rent expense for the short-term lease and low-value leases. What we put back in is the depreciation, 850 million, because that's the depreciation on the right of use asset, so our EBITDA will go up, 850 million. And we have 22 million gain from the IFRS 16, as I also already explained, these are the termination of leases, 16 million. 17 million and 5 million reversal of impairments. So you come up to the 227 break. If you look at our margin, like I said, the depreciation expense is less than our old rent expense, so our margin is going up. The reason is because interest is known is not included in our margin. Our overall margin will go up around 30 base points, which you see here. But it's not the same per second. So let me briefly explain what happens per second. First one is the United States. So our margin is going up with 30 base points. And there, if you look at the composition of the margin increase, I think there are multiple brands, but we have former out USA retail, and we have Valley's America, and the margin for retail will go up a little bit more compared to Valley's America. And the reason is merger accounting. So at the merger, 2015, which is a true merger, you need to do a purchase price allocation accounting for Del Has, so I was identified as the acquirer and Del Has was identified as the acquirer. So for merger accounting, for all leases, you reset the discount rate. So this was happened in July 2016. So all leases for the former Del Has have a starting date, a commencement date of the 24th July 2016. At that time, in most of our countries, the discount rate was rather low, because we still are in a low discount rate environment. Both in the US, the Netherlands and Belgium, the discount rate was low, with the exception of Greece, connecting. So that's why we see a less increase of our margin for the US America compared to our retail. If you look at the Netherlands, 0.3%. We have a rather mature lease portfolio, so we don't have merger accounting in the Netherlands. So if you look at the composition of our lease portfolio, we have leases, I think the oldest one is from 1960s, but are mainly from somewhere maybe before the economic crisis in 2008, some after. So we have quite a mixed portfolio, resulting in a mix of interest rates, low and higher, a little higher, so the impact is 0.3%. For Belgium, the impact is very limited, and for Belgium, the reason is that all these leases started in July 2016. The interest rates for Utrecht was 1.2%, which is rather low. But there's another impact. In Belgium, we have a lot of affiliated stores, franchisees. So what happens is that in most cases we are the head lease, so we have a contract with the landlord on the store, and we fully sublease this to our affiliated stores. So then you basically de-recognize it from the right interest. You don't have this, you have an offset in your interest expense which you pay and the interest income that you receive on the sublease. That's why there's limited impact on CSE. You see a much bigger impact on CSE, 70 base points. And here you see the impact of mainly discount rates for countries like Serbia, Romania, and Greece. And in particular, Greece, all these countries went to the merger accounting. And in Greece, in 2016, we were at the top of the Euro crisis, the credit crisis in Greece, so which increased the rates in Greece, so we have a high discount rate in Greece. You see the impact, you have more interest expense, less depreciation, margin will go up. Look at our store portfolio. In total we have around 10,000 contracts in scope for IFRS 16. 4,000 are cars, 1,000 subleases, and around 5,000 contracts for stores. You cannot tie this number, someone wants to look to our store portfolio, and the reason is that sometimes you might have two or three contracts for a particular store. It could be that you opened the store 10 years ago, and 5 years later you expanded the store, so you could have two different contracts, so you cannot have that. If you look at our lease terms, then you'll see that in the United States we have the longest lease terms. And there also we see a difference between out USA retail and the Has America. Contracts in the Has America are somewhat shorter, in average 8 to 9 years. And there is a reason behind this, and I think it mainly relates to land leases. So what we have done at retail, we leased land, but constructed our own store on this land. We have renewal options on this lease for this land. And if you construct your own building on it, you expect that you will use this lease as long as you use the building. So if you use the building for 30, 35 years, then you also have a lease company with a lease term. Same that's why it increases a bit the average lease term for the year. The Netherlands, it's 10, quite a mature portfolio. Belgium, it's 11. And maybe also CSE is 11. To explain what happens here. So in some of these countries, so let me give an example of Belgium. We enter in contracts of around 27 or sometimes 30 years. But these contracts have an option to terminate the contract after 3 years or with a very low penalty. So what they've done to set the lease term is not use the really contractual term. We looked at, for example, what is the store that we have opened at that location. And if we do a remodeling, so let's say after 10 years, we set the lease term also around this. Because we have the option to exit this store by the issue. Average remaining lease term, there you can see that in particular in the Netherlands, it's 5 out of 10, we are 5 years to go. In the US also around 50%, 14, a little bit more. But we have quite a mature lease portfolio. Not like we have all new leases or all leases, we have quite a mature lease portfolio. That is also the reason why our front-loading impact in our P&L is not so significant, because we have a mix of old and new leases. Belgium, CSE, you see a bit the impact of merger accounting, 9 and 8. So all the leases starts there July 2016, of course some new are added. 2 years after the merger, well, the average went down. Discount rates. So we provided you information about the weighted average discount rates for stores. And here you see that in the US, maybe it's good to explain the methodology about discount rates. I think there are a couple of factors. There are macroeconomic factors. So to calculate the discount rate, you start with the risk-free rate. It would be for Europe, the German bonds, and for the US, the US. Treasury bonds, and then you add premiums or your discount for factors. So you add macroeconomic premiums, country risk, currency risk, which you also add premium for the company risk, and you take into consideration that a lease is a collateralized debt, so you discount a bit because the bond is uncollateralized. So that drives these average discount rates, but it is over the lease portfolio. So the US is 4.4, and let me explain the Netherlands and Belgium. So of course in the Netherlands we are in extreme low interest environment as well as Belgium. And you see the difference that Belgium is a little bit lower, because Belgium, it all started July 2016, and the Netherlands we still have some old leases which brings the discount rate a bit up. And CEC 5.7% here, you see the impact of currently Greece, but also Serbia, Romania and Czech have some higher interest rates because the country risk is higher than, for example, in the Netherlands. Of course, this chart doesn't change within one quarter. Discount rates also will not change within one quarter. It's not like pension accounting, where there could be an immediate impact. It will change over time. And of course, every day we will add new contracts. Some contracts will end. So probably if you look maybe 5 years ahead from now, and we make the same charge, the discount rate will change. When discount rates change, they will impact our margin going forward. So in Greece, if the discount rate is dropping, because the Greece economy is going through its recovery, and we renew a lot of new leases, then going forward, we have lower interest, meaning higher depreciation expense, meaning that there would be some pressure on the margin. The opposite effect will happen in the Netherlands and Belgium. So if going forward our discount rates will go up again, so then we have more interest, less depreciation, so our margin will improve somewhat. But like I said, will not happen in a quarter, will take a while, because first a lease contract needs to end, because you don't true up your interest rate throughout the lease term.
It's a year, we still have long average lease terms.
But every day we enter new contract, it is on a portfolio basis. Then to explain the movements on the balance sheet, yeah, I've explained the income statement. And what we have done is made a bridge of the total assets. And first of all, what you see is that we reclassified finance leases. So we were already rich in finance leases, yeah, I think around 15 to 20%. They are still on the balance sheet, but now we call them the right of use assets. So we de-recognize the old finance lease, which was already on the balance sheet. On the IFRS 16, we don't have any favorable or unfavorable lease rights. These favorable and unfavorable lease rights, they emerge when you do purchase price allocation, where you acquire a company, you acquire also lease contracts. We have favorable lease rights here, and it's an intangible asset. So basically, we de-recognize that, and we basically add it to the right of use assets. So now our assets put on the balance sheet, we have a significant amount of sublease receivables. So these are the finance sublease receivables. So when we have sent the risk and rewards of this particular part in the store to somebody else, this is the Dunkin' Donut example, but then with a 10-year contract. And we have some other movements, which are the restatement of the joint venture, some prepaid expense, and a deferred tax asset. And up, you see an increase to almost 40 billion. And it's good to mention that we already in the annual report explained the movement for total assets as a bullet item. That was the item by the 1st of January 2018. On the slide is the end of 2018, so this will be the end of December 2020. We can do the same for our total liability. So this is also at the end of the year. You see an equity impact of 611. And in the beginning I mentioned that the opening balance impact was 580 million on equity, which this is so the end of the balance sheet. So what happens is you need to add the IFRS 16 2018 restatement impact, which I think is 13 million, and we have some translation differences because if you change the balance sheet, you need to recalculate also in your consolidation. So that is the 611. We have a deferred tax liability movement, and it's a negative, so actually it is a deferred tax asset, but netted with our deferred tax liability. And then we have the liability, let's say the new liability. These two buckets, the long-term portion and the short-term portion, which is an adding to our net debt number of 7.9 billion, more or less. And then in the other bucket, we have step rent. So let me explain the concept of step rents. So in Europe, leases, normally you increase every year your lease by a CPI index, so there is an inflation adjustment every year. In the US, we don't have that. We have a lot of contracts where it's already incorporated in the contract itself. So in year one, you pay 100. In year two, you pay 102. In year three, you pay 104. So which is step rent under the old standard. We all smoothened that. So we had a huge accrual for step rent, that's 285 million. So this no longer exists because now we already have the full liability on the balance sheet. So that is included in here. We have the unfavorable lease rights, so the favorable were an asset, the unfavorable a liability, so both are gone, so this is also removed from the balance sheet. And then we have onerous contracts provision, so when a contract is no longer profitable, around 60 million, we don't need to include that on the balance sheet because we already have the full liability stated in here.
so that you already report the full liability, there's no need to report on this contract provision because the liability is already there. So in total, an increase also to 40 billion. And you see, and Jeff will explain how the net debt will go up to 7.9 billion. You also should take into consideration that other liabilities will go down, like this one. And we have a tax impact there as well. And I think already explained this in the annual report, but then we made a bullet for the total liabilities. I think these are and highlights the impact of IFRS 16, but I'm ready for questions.
Well,
after you,
I'm sure we'll come back.
Slides.
I'm sure there'll be some questions. Very quickly, I'll summarize. Well, I'll complete the process. I wanted to talk about free cash flow. In the old definition of free cash flow, we had a split between operating lease rental, which obviously was included in the standard, but as part of financing costs, we included the finance lease repayments below the line as if it was debt repayment, effectively. And that was very clearly spelled out in the full cash flow. We have a decision to make. What do we do effectively with from a free cash flow perspective? So we decided to include all of the lease cash impacts, including old finance leases and operating leases, in the free cash flow line. That's a new definition of free cash flow, which comes down 177 million. Obviously, the net cash from financing, the net cash position at the bottom line, and our total cash and cash equivalents isn't affected. We're just including the 177 million in the net cash flow. Free cash flow calculation, whereas before it was included effectively as part of a debt repayment, as if it was debt repayment. So we will see a reduced free cash flow in the definition, but obviously it doesn't change our cash generation or our net cash position. It's just the way we've defined free cash flow effectively now includes this charge where it was excluded before. As we mentioned, debt, there's a 7.1 billion adjustment in total liabilities, but in terms of net debt, the increase is 7.9 billion, given the 10.8 billion on the balance sheet. So in terms of some of the key guidance we've given in the past, it's just a net debt to EBITDA, for example, that does increase because we've got a larger amount of debt on the balance sheet compared to how we calculated the lease adjusted net debt in the past. This is a larger addition, but it will have no impact on our capital allocation policy. And in terms of our guidance going forward, we won't talk about a target net debt to EBITDA. We'll just talk about maintaining our strong credit metrics within the credit ratings that we have. I introduced that guidance back in 2011 when effectively there wasn't a lot of discussion about lease adjusted net debt. There was a lot of discussion about the fact that we had pretty much zero debt on the balance sheet. We had about $4 billion of cash. So there's a need to introduce a measure which gave us some understanding of how we would go forward. I don't think it's needed in going forward, but I don't think there will also be any change in terms of our capital allocation policy. We'll continue to operate within the credit metrics, both in Moody's and S&P, and we'll be able, I think, in terms of how we go about allocating free cash flow, we'll continue with the policy that we've adopted. So the last chart, just to summarize. No real impact on cash. Underlying operating margin increases by 30 basis points. I think it's going to be particularly difficult when we start doing U.S. comparatives because they're the U.S. business margins don't change as a consequence of U.S. GAAP introduction of the standards, so there's no change in the margin of the our U.S. peers. So I think that's something we have to bear in mind going forward. Underlying EPS changes 3 cents per share, which is mostly in relation to the taking out the gain on lease termination that Bouton mentioned. Free cash flow now includes the repayment of finance leases. They were always there. They were just outside free cash flow and below the line. We will include those going forward. And net debt, as we mentioned, increased to $7.9 billion. Our guidance and outlook remains pretty much unchanged. Obviously, no effect on synergies and Save for Our Customer. We continue to give guidance that our restated group underlying operating profit margin will be in line for 2019 with 2018. That's the guidance we gave at the Capital Markets Day. Underlying earnings per share will grow high single digits, and again, that's from a restated 2018 to 2019 restated. And free cash flow, obviously, will come down based on the adjustment of the repayment of finance leases. So with that, we open it up to questions. I'm sure there will be some, and the bouncer will help you with the questions, depending on how technical you want to get. I'll stop. Okay, Bruno?
On finance leases, when you spend CapEx in the old days on a finance lease, it would show up in your CapEx numbers and say you spent 100 million euro, but it was a non-cash CapEx numbers. Right? Because you commit to a new finance lease, you didn't have to spend the money. So in a way, am I right to think that in the past you had the benefit of non-cash capex financing in the past and your free cash flow, the cash you paid for paying back the finance leases was below the free cash flow. Normally you think about finance leases, you don't pay it up front, but you pay it later. Here, if you have a steady state of finance lease before, you just shouldn't really make a damn difference to your free cash flow. Going back to this point, did you in the past have the benefit of non-cash capex finance leases and free cash flow? Because that would be the only reason why, you know, if the cash is going down, cash outflows.
So the question is, was a finance lease treated as capital expenditure?
If you buy a truck, spend 10 million,
yep.
I did the cash and capex outflow. If you did a finance lease, you might commit to 10 million lease on the van, but you didn't put it in your capex number.
Yep.
Or then you actually had the cash spent.
No, I believe the finance leases were effectively not treated as capital in that case.
So you didn't have them?
Sorry?
So you did not have them in the capital?
No, the capex was cash capex, money spent.
So if you had a 10 million dollar truck, it wouldn't be in there because you didn't spend it on the trucks, you didn't want to take the trucks.
Difference between statutory capex and cash flow capex, isn't
it? Yeah. Cash capex, which is the number we refer to, obviously doesn't include the finance leases. In terms of statutory capex, where we bring it onto the balance sheet, it must be include in there as well. Yeah.
The way you define your free cash flow in the past, you would have used your cash capex rather than statutory capex. When you talk about your free cash flow target, that's $1 billion based on cash capex.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Go ahead.
Can you allude to the fact that comparability will be impaired versus your US peers?
Mm-hmm.
So will you commit to allowing us to be able to see the backtrack on the adjustments? And then secondly, within that, your disclosure has always been very good. But one of the challenges, I think, has been reconciling the bottom of the cash flow statement to the changes in net debt, and obviously that reconciliation or analysis of net debt now becomes acutely important if we want to try and back into old money free cash flow, which, you know, cash is cash, but your free cash flow number is moving this morning in reporting terms but not in actual terms, so
right.
it matters more.
First question was on the P&L, yeah?
Just generally across the piece, so particularly with respect to operating margins, where obviously you get a lot of questions about high operating margins as it is, and now yours is going to go up.
Yeah. Going to stay technically, and one of my biggest challenges is make sure the operators don't trade that away, because they think, oh, 4.3% margin, that's very high. Well, actually, you're still just,
so
in old money, you're still a 4% margin.
You're able to get to an old money margin.
It's going to be, we won't be due reporting. It's going to be very difficult, because the distinction between an operating lease and a finance lease from an accounting perspective disappears. And we're not tagging things as old finance leases and therefore trying to recalculate in our accounting systems. But we can estimate that reasonably accurately, so we will be given some kind of estimates of what that would have been, certainly for a transition period. Now, the 30 basis points that we refer to for the group, and it's 30 basis points for the U.S., over a long period of time may change, and I think it's fair to say quarter by quarter it's the same number. It's not, over a long period of time that may change slightly, but it's not. It takes some time for that to change. It takes some time for the lease portfolio to change, interest rates to change. But we can estimate it, so we will give an estimate on the, and we'll try and be as transparent as possible in terms of the net debt movements and the free cash flow, because, yeah, clearly you're correct. The total cash generated in the business doesn't change, but our definition of what we call free cash flow is changing. We could have excluded all leases from that. I don't think there's a standard being developed by our peers as to what free cash flow now includes.
So you've been conservative, but if being conservative, it'd be helpful.
Yeah, being conservative, it brings the free cash flow number down, but and we'll be as transparent about that as possible.
Definitely can do it for 2019.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. How long is the quarter, the net profit?
That's really difficult to estimate, because still the lease portfolio changes every day. Yeah? So if you have around 10,000 contracts, and the average is close to 10 to 11 years, so you renew 1,000 contracts per year. So I think I can hardly predict when it reverses, because there's so many elements that have an impact on it. I think, well, maybe to give some estimate from due to merger accounting, we're now 2.5 years away from that, so like 8 to 10 years, so I think in 2 years' time.
And the other question I have is just on the...
So you get a slight EPS benefit, two or three cents reversing, possibly in over 3 years or something.
So it seems like a good moment to remind us on some of the details of your property portfolio. So actually, I don't know broadly what percentage of property is,
although
very low.
Well, it's always been about 20% owned, and I think that was fair to say of the Ahold and the Delhaize portfolios, it was around a 20-80 mix. And obviously the benefit of that is you can tweak your portfolio with leased assets more easily. So it was always about 20, it's sitting about 20-80 in terms of owned versus leased.
And a geeky question. On the
they are within the lease liability.
But that shouldn't change materially, because, you know, the passage of time, the rent goes up.
No, for the step rents, it is included. So for Europe, we have more CPI index related rents. You cannot predict them.
You assume the CPI holds probably where it is.
Well, if you know them, then they're sure. But the CPI index in the coming year, you pay that. Going forward for the lease, you threw up the liability for that.
That was
So for the US, I would say it's included. That's the, we have a different concept there. It's the step rent concept. For Europe, it's not.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, the rating agencies, have you discussed this with all rating agencies? Are they happy they're not going to change the template on them?
Yes, they're happy. There'll be no changes in terms of ratings. I think the rating agencies are still really finalizing their own methodology in terms of how they take this forward. I can't remember what exactly S&P said, but I think they're going to stick with their current methodology.
Yeah, so I think the rating agency already had a methodology to include operational these expenses in their valuations. And we talked to Standard & Poor's and they estimated it pretty close, I think.
Yeah, but I don't think there's any... so they'd already estimated, both rating agencies had estimated the impact on ourselves relative to their previous methodology, and there'll be no change to the rating or the impact on ourselves. But I think how the rating agencies go forward, I think that's still to be determined in terms of do they change their methodology or not.
Were they using a discount? Were they using similar methods to what you used here, or did they use strength?
No, but they've calculated based on the standard. So they've known for some time what our estimated number would be, and they calculated that based on how they estimated the impact of the standard. So we had a fairly similar number when we sat down 6 months ago with S&P. They understood the impact. This is a higher net debt position than they'd previously calculated with 8 times kind of rentals.
Yeah.
But they didn't see it having any impact, material impact on our rating.
And a quick one, on the 177 finance charge, does that include interest?
That includes the interest.
And what's
the split, roughly? That is a very good question, but I don't know this by heart, and it's difficult to calculate. So in particular, if you have a lease with a rent-free period, and you don't pay anything in the first year, you pay the second year, but you pay also interest in the first year, so then how do you really calculate it? That's the reason why we said it's better to have one number, which is redemption and the interest.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Discussing the minimum lease, where you have a lease break that you can exercise after a while, can you just elaborate? I wasn't sure. You were assuming that you would break the lease at that point, if you say I have a 5-year break clause, or did you assume that you extend it?
You're talking about the ground rents in the U.S., particularly where we lease the land, and perhaps we build a store on top of that land. So typically they may have breaks after 5 or 10 years, but under the standard, it requires you to take the assumed length of that lease as long as you're intending to use the property. So if you intend to use the property and depreciate over 30 years, you have to assume you extend the lease contracts through those extensions up to 30 years. So that's one of the principal reasons our previously reported contingent liability for lease liabilities was a lower number, because we assumed to the first break point in many of this, not quite as accurate as that, but we assume for the first break point to calculate that contingent liability. The standard requires you to take the land leases as far out as the assumed use of the property. That's pretty much the main impact there.
And the other question is the repayment of financial leases, the $177 million, was it similar in previous years? Is that kind of
That's pretty standard. It's been a pretty flat number. Go ahead.
Yes, one of the kind of painful questions I can come up against, I'm calling it a copy, but they keep asking a separation of the lease payment between cash flow, whether or not there'll be a sort of few interest components that we've whacked down in the financing.
So, Now, cash flow statements going forward will present the combined number, the redemption of the financial liability, as well as the repayment of our receivables.
Okay, so that's your cash flow.
Yeah. So we disclose the interest expense and the interest income, which is in the P&L, but in the cash flow it is the combined. The reason, like I said, it's so hard to calculate it if you have rent-free periods. Same when you have a loan, which is paid in kind loan. If you add the interest to the loan itself, and when you make a redemption, the question is, what is the redemption? Is that interest repayment or redemption of the principal? How do you allocate?
Yeah.
Just to pick up on the Netherlands, you mentioned that you take the lease over 10 years because of the refurbishment. Can you give me an idea of roughly how long beyond that 10 years they actually need to
transfer? So for the Netherlands, so first of all, this number is the portfolio number. Eh? So it is our, I don't know how many contracts in Netherlands by heart, if you like, 1,000. So what you do on a lease-by-lease basis, you make an assessment how long are you going to stay in this location. So you basically first start with the contractual term, and most contracts in the Netherlands also include an option to extend your contractual term. So you take into account, I stay for 10 or 15 years. It really depends per location. It could be that we have a very good location in the heart of Amsterdam, where we maybe say it's 20 years, or it could be we have a location somewhere else in the Netherlands, we say it's only 10 years, because after 10 years we remodel and take a new economic decision if we'd like to stay or not at this location.
I thought
the numbers are the portfolio.
Right. I have another question. I know you mentioned a number of times to change how you run your business.
I don't think it changes the commerciality of the contracts. Over a period of time, perhaps around the fringes, but I think generally, I don't think it's going to change the kind of average lease contract or how we think about operating leases and such forth. So I don't think it'll have an impact on the commerciality of how we enter into these contracts. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry if I missed this one. Just when will be the first report where you actually present all five of it?
Q1. We're doing full financials, so obviously Q1 will be under the new standard. It's just a call, so we'll just get very sort of, you know, we'll make sure that the line on the call isn't very good.
Well, that's why we provided the Q1 restated numbers as well, so you can compare to Q1 2018.
And that's why we're doing this now, so that for Q1 there's ample time. I know a lot of UK companies are reporting only the half year, so that will be later in this year before you see any actual reported IFRS numbers for a lot of, I guess we'll be one of the first out with actual numbers under the new standard. Yeah.
Just on that, you're going to start, I suppose, more on an annual basis, some pressure on margins from discount rates changing. Either way, are you going to start giving us an idea of what that movement is in a year, or is it not going to be a material number?
I suspect it won't be a material number, but if we see a material change, 10 basis points change in margin, then we can explain it. But I don't expect that you really see a material change in the margin. So I think that 30 basis points estimate, what we've given now and rolling that forward, will be pretty accurate.
And then will you provide any sort of mapping from reported EBITDA and cash EBITDA are quite different now? Are you going to provide any sort of mapping to get
If there's a significant difference, we will.
We have a few people on the phone. Thanks for your patience. Operator, can we take some questions from the people on the phone right now?
Of course, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, as said, if you have a question or remark, please press star 1 so I can open up your line. Star 1 for your question or remark. Go ahead, please. Star 1 for your question or remark. At the moment, there seems to be no questions, sir.
All right, okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
No, I don't.
We'll be available for any follow-up.
Okay. Final questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Can I come back on your capital allocation? Because in the past, you had kind of 2 times.
Yeah.
Now we are 2.6 times, where, if I remember correctly, that last year you said we will go a little bit beyond that in our old definition. So you said we will stop giving the target number, but for us to calculate how much can return...
I'm surprised this question ended up last.
So how should we calculate going forward what potential is to return for capital return? If the 2 times is no longer key,
I think so. For example, if I kept to the 2 times, we'd have a period of time where we are paying back to get to the 2 times and have less surplus cash.
But this is a different definition.
Yeah, but it's a different definition. So, in your model, I would consider the adjustment to be an absolute change in the adjustment and model it the same way. I'm not going to change my policy on capital returns because we've had an accounting change, if you see what I mean. So I don't want to give guidance, and I'll say it at this meeting, and then I'm not going to kind of come back to this 2 times definition, but effectively the 2 times is equivalent to about 2.5 times going forward, and that's the new world that we live in. So we'll work with the new level.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much, everyone. If you want to hang around for one-on-one questions, I'll be here for another 15 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the call. You may now disconnect your line. Have a nice day.